I'm very glad to appear with Dr. Harvey Sickerman. We refer to him as Dr. Harvey Sickerman precisely because he's so good at divining syndromes and defining them. And he's actually the author of a more famous one than the ones he talked about today, which he's just introduced. It's called the Gewalt Syndrome. And I'll leave it to him to describe it, but it's one that I've been citing all these years. So thank you, Harvey, for your new innovations. And you've given me a good framework, I think, for what I wanted to talk about, which was President Clinton's last year and the process of handoff to President Bush, what we can learn from that, and what I think it would be wise for President Bush to avoid if he is, in fact, to learn from history. I think it's true to say that Clinton suffered from the legacy syndrome, the second term syndrome in that sense, particularly because of his circumstances in his last 2 years in office. And I do think that he was particularly driven by that sense of history, very much aware of it, very concerned about what his legacy would be if he were able to achieve what he aimed for then, which was a comprehensive peace, not just on the Palestinian track, but the Syrian track as well, and what his legacy would be if he didn't. I don't think he was afflicted with the Jerusalem syndrome simply because, unlike President Bush, he'd been devoted to this objective for 8 years. In that last year, and particularly in the last months, I think that he was very much focused on an almost desperate attempt to try to reach an agreement. And when he failed, he handed off a peace process that was in flames to President Bush. And I wanted to tell just a couple of short anecdotes in that regard because they serve to illustrate the point very well. In his handoff meeting with the new president, President Clinton was quite worked up about what had happened, particularly in his last weeks in office, and he said to President Bush, "Don't you ever trust that son of a bitch Yasser Arafat. He'll lie to you like he lied to me." And from somebody who was in that meeting, he told me that it was very hard to get Clinton off this case. He was so worked up about it. I dare say that made quite an impression on President Bush in the day before he took office. I saw President Bush, the only meeting actually I had with him. I was still ambassador in Israel for the first 6 months of the Bush term, and I came back with newly elected Prime Minister Sharon for his first meeting with President Bush. And afterwards, the president asked me to stay behind, and he said, "What happened?" And I won't bore you with my answer, but he said, he kind of nodded his head. He said, "President Clinton and Prime Minister Barak were two desperate men chasing after a deal. They made Arafat a very generous offer, and he rejected it and resorted to violence. And now Sharon is Prime Minister, and he's not going to offer what Barak offered and what Arafat has already rejected. Therefore, there's no Nobel Peace Prize to be had here." And he kind of smiled that smug smile. And that was his conclusion. And that was his conclusion in March of 2001. And that was his abiding conclusion for 7 years in office. He pursued a determined policy of disengagement from trying to resolve this conflict or even to try to move the process forward in an effective way. That he's come around to pursue not just a peace process, but a peace treaty by the end of his last year in office is clearly, I think, a result of the factors that, that Harvey has analysed. But I think the lesson we should learn from what happened between Clinton and Bush is to avoid that kind of handoff, because the consequences for American engagement in trying to resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict could be quite profound. And at this juncture, those who want to see a resolution of the Arab-Israeli conflict should want to avoid that at all costs. There are several other important lessons from President Clinton's last year in office that are apposite to this situation today. The second one is about the strategic context. Our efforts to try to achieve comprehensive peace were focused in the first part of the last year of the Clinton administration on trying to achieve an Israeli-Syrian agreement. When we failed to achieve that in Geneva, that, I would argue, with the benefit of hindsight, foredoomed our efforts to try to achieve an Israeli-Palestinian final status agreement. Because it dramatically impacted on the calculations of the Palestinians. I don't have time to go into all of these details, so I'll just summarize them. Barak's offer of full withdrawal to a line based on the line of 1967 when it came to the Golan Heights set a standard that the Palestinians could not, would not depart from. The failure to achieve an agreement there resulted in short order in May of 2000 to the Barak's decision to unilaterally withdraw from Lebanon, which allowed Hezbollah to claim correctly that violence forced an Israeli withdrawal and that that was the way to achieve liberation of territory, which impacted dramatically on a debate that was then going on inside the Palestinian National Movement about whether negotiations or violence was the way to go, and had a direct impact then on the launching of the Intifada. And perhaps most importantly of all, Arafat went from feeling left out of the process and very anxious about finding a way into it, fearing that Israel and Syria were going to do a deal, to being in the catbird seat, where if Clinton was to achieve anything in his last year in office and Barak was to achieve something in his first year in office, in fact, to achieve his own political salvation, he had to, they both had to chase after Arafat. And that had dramatic implications for the artful dodger as he went into Camp David. So we need to bear in mind the strategic context and the calculations that leaders are going to make as the president this time sallies forth to try to achieve his Israeli-Palestinian agreement. I would say the third lesson relates to the objective. Had we had the benefit of hindsight, we obviously didn't. Had we understood at the time, and it's very hard when you're in the cockpit to understand all these things that are going on around you, I think with hindsight we would have realized that we needed to lower our objectives. And rather than go to Camp David to try to achieve a comprehensive framework agreement between the Israelis and Palestinians, we would have been better off focusing on something that was more achievable in the circumstances. Again, I don't have time to go into all of this, but I would argue that there was a territorial deal that was achievable at Camp David had we focused on territory. But we ended up focusing on Jerusalem, for which there was no solution then, and I suspect there is still no solution now that's politically acceptable to both sides. And that underscores the need to be realistic about what can be achieved this year, especially in circumstances where 7 years of neglect has led to the complete destruction of trust between the two parties, of capabilities of the Palestinian authority to control the territory that might be ceded to it in any peace agreement, particularly when we have the Palestinian side divided, both physically in terms of Hamas under Gaza's control, Gaza under Hamas's control, and the West Bank nominally under Abu Mazen's control, but also in terms of the real division that exists ideologically between Hamas's view of how to settle the conflict, its one-state solution versus Fatah's two-state solution. So it's very important to be realistic. And once we failed at Camp David, we then needed to reassess, especially after the outbreak of the Intifada. Again, in retrospect, to redouble our efforts to achieve an Israeli-Palestinian full-fledged framework agreement at that time, when the ground was burning under the feet of the would-be peacemakers, actually became a march of folly. And the lesson there is we needed to pay attention to what was going on the ground rather than trying to focus on an agreement that was increasingly detached from the dynamic that had been unleashed as a result of the Second Intifada. And so this, when applied, these lessons, when applied to the current situation, I think have pretty clear implications. As I said at the beginning, the objective should be, as Harvey also suggested, to hand off a working process that the next president can pick up with 4 years in office and perhaps then drive to a successful conclusion. But to try to achieve now in the current circumstances, which are so adverse, a peace agreement is a bridge much too far and has the great danger that instead of handing off a working process, what we're going to see is a real breakdown, violence, and that, I believe, will only benefit Hamas and its supporters, Hezbollah, Palestine Islamic Jihad, and of course, Iran. I think that the Secretary of State has put together the architecture of a viable process if the focus was on handing off to the next administration. This, what I'd refer to as a kind of four or five level structure in which there are negotiations focused on trying to define what the end game would look like. There is a process of trying to rebuild confidence in the intentions of each side through fulfillment of their roadmap commitments. The Israelis to stop all settlement activity, including natural growth and dismantle illegal settlement outposts. The Palestinians to end incitement and begin the process of dismantling the infrastructure of terror, and the United States to monitor that process makes sense in terms of the effort to rebuild confidence. Third level is to rebuild the Palestinian structures of governance, in particular the security services, because without a capable security service, it is inconceivable that the IDF will withdraw from the West Bank. It is inconceivable that any territorial agreement about the disposition of the West Bank could be implemented. On a fourth level, the rebuilding of the jump-starting of the Palestinian economy, the Blair Project foreign investment into the West Bank economy to get some of these projects that have long been on the shelf off the ground also makes sense, so that Palestinians can see that there is a benefit from supporting an effort at a two-state solution. The engagement of the Arab states is also an important process that we did too little of in the last year of the Clinton administration, and has become possible now because of the Arab League Peace Initiative and the interest of at least some Arab states in showing that negotiations and conciliation work better than violence and terrorism in terms of meeting the needs of the Palestinian people. But what's essential is to take what is a logical structure and move it forward on all of these levels. And to the extent that you can do that, you can create a symbiosis in which one progress on one level will reinforce progress on the others. But we don't see that happening. The Blair Project is at best a part-time project. I don't think at the moment he even has a functioning office in Jerusalem. He himself was quoted in the Financial Times yesterday as saying that there needs to be more urgency to the effort. But that applies to him too. President went out there, raised expectations sky high, and as far as we can see, nothing has happened since then except bad things relating to Gaza and the border with Egypt. I thought the Secretary of State was going out there. I don't know what's happened to that now. But we do know that left to their own devices, the parties themselves, notwithstanding their declarations and insightful analyses of their interests, will not be able to move this complicated structure forward without our heavy and active engagement. And that's not a syndrome. That's a requirement. The syndrome that seems to be at work here is what I call the Harry Potter syndrome, where the president, he doesn't have a magic wand, but he picked up a magic sword in Saudi Arabia, which you all probably saw, and he waves it around and says, abracadabra, and I'll check back in with you in May, and then maybe we'll see how you're doing. Well, that clearly will not work. It's really important to try to get all of these things moving on the ground in order to reach that objective of a handoff of a viable process. We've also have the situation now where a dangerous concept has been introduced as part of this Harry Potter syndrome. It's called the shelf agreement. I don't know who was the genius that invented this terminology. I accused David Makovsky of it, but he denies.
Don't look at us. don't look at us, yes, sir.
But a shelf agreement is precisely what we don't want now. This is part of the second term syndrome in which you're affected by history and you you want to reach the agreement, so you call it a shelf agreement because you know it's going to be totally detached from the reality on the ground. And so that's why it's on the shelf. But Israelis and Palestinians have seen this. It wasn't called the shelf agreement, it was called Oslo. And they're both highly skeptical of it. To imagine that you could conclude a shelf agreement and then sell it to the Israeli and Palestinian public is a dangerous illusion. And instead, I think it's an urgent requirement now for the Secretary of State to define and get the leadership of the Israelis and the Palestinians to sign on to a reasonable, achievable objective when it comes to the negotiation level of this process. Finally, I think it's important, if you think back to what I was saying about the strategic context, to introduce a sixth level to this architecture, and that is an Israeli-Syrian negotiation. Not as we did then to try to make it the focus of our first step, not to pursue a Syria first process, but a Syria also process, because that will have a number of advantages if the objective is to pass on a viable process to the next administration. It will give cover to Abu Mazen and the Arab leaders who have an interest in engaging this process. It will create tensions between Syria and Iran and put Iran somewhat more on the defensive, as well as tensions with its proxies who happen to have their headquarters in Damascus. That, of course, includes Hamas, but also Palestine Islamic Jihad. And contrary to the fear in the administration that it will lead to a sellout of Lebanon, I believe it can actually do much to protect our interest in a free Lebanon, particularly if an Israel-Lebanon negotiation was started as well. And I'll be happy to get into the details of that in the Q&A, but I think that if the administration were to focus on the achievable and move what is a complicated effort forward in the way that I've suggested, then it would deserve full credit, and President Bush could go down in history as having made a signal contribution to the effort to achieve peace in the Holy Land. Thank you very much.